Our passage this evening comes from 2 Samuel 17 and verses 1 to 23. 2 Samuel 17, now we'll begin reading at verse 1. Then Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Let me choose 12,000 men, and I'll get up and go after David tonight. And I will come on him while he's weary and discouraged. And I shall rout him, and all the people who are with him shall flee, and I shall only strike down the king. And I will bring back all the people to you. The return of everyone rests on the man you are seeking. All the people will be at peace." And the advice seemed right to Absalom and all the elders of Israel. And then Absalom said, "Please call Hushai the Archite as well, and let us hear what he also has to say." So Hushai came to Absalom, and Absalom said to him, "Ahithophel has spoken this way. Should we do what he says? If not, you speak." Then Hushai said to Absalom, "The advice Ahithophel has given this time is not good." Hushai continued, "You know your father and his men, what warriors they are, and terribly bitter like a bear robbed of her cubs in the country. And your father's a man of war, and he won't spend the night with the people. Why, even now he's hidden himself in one of the pits or in one of the other places. And then when some of them fall at the beginning and someone hears the report and someone says a blow has come against the people who follow Absalom, then even the bravest soldier whose heart is like the heart of a lion will totally melt in fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a warrior and those with him are brave fighters. But I advise, let all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, like the sand on the seashore in number, with you personally going among them. And we shall come to him in one of the places where he is found, and we shall come down on him as the dew falls on the ground, and no one will be left, not he or any of the men with him. And should he gather himself into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the stream bed until not even a pebble can be found." Then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel." Now Yahweh had ordained to frustrate the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that Yahweh might bring disaster upon Absalom. Now Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, "This is how Ahithophel advised Absalom and the elders of Israel, and this is how I advised him. So now hurry and tell David, do not spend the night at the fords of the wilderness. Rather, you must immediately cross over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up." And Jonathan and Ahimaaz were standing ready at the spring of Rogel. And a maidservant went and told them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they could not be seen entering the city. But a lad saw them and told Absalom. So both of them went quickly and came to the house of a man in Bakarim. He had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into it. Then the wife took and spread a covering over the top of the well and spread around some drying grain over it, and no one knew any different. When Absalom's servants came to the woman at the house, they said, "Where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan?" And the woman said to them, "They've crossed over the stream of water." So they searched, but did not find them, and so returned to Jerusalem. After they went off, they came up from the well and went and told King David. They said to David, "Get up and hurry across the water, for here's how Ahithophel has advised against you." So David rose up and all the people who were with him and went on crossing the Jordan until morning light, until there was no one who had not crossed the Jordan. Now Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been carried out. So he saddled his donkey, got up and went to his house, to his city. He organized his affairs and hung himself. So he died and was buried in his father's grave. Now it was in December of 1958. He was almost 43 years old. Archie Moore was trying to defend his light heavyweight boxing championship, and he was defending it against a Canadian, Yvonne Durrell, who was only 30 years old. It didn't look really good for Archie Moore. Durrell knocked Archie Moore down 3 times in the first round, and again in the 5th round. But as the bout went on, the older Archie Moore seemed to gain strength and Durrell seemed to tire, so that in the 11th round, Archie Moore recorded his record 127th knockout. But it looked like he was down for the count. There's something about tenacious endurance. And that's what you see in the way Yahweh supports and preserves his kingdom here. We're in 2 Samuel 17, and we're in the middle of Absalom's rebellion back in chapters 15 and 16. And at the end of chapter 16, in verses 20 to 23, it may look like David and company are down for the count. And, of course, as we said, that sort of indicates also, as was part of the fulfillment of Yahweh's own word and chastisement of David in chapter 12, verses 10 to 12, where he said, "I will raise up disaster for you out of your own house." And indeed, Absalom rebels against him, his own son, etc., tries to take the kingdom. So that's fulfilling a word of the Lord. But there's another word that Yahweh spoke that comes into play. It's 2 Samuel 7, verse 16, in the covenant with David. "Your house and your kingship shall be made firm forever before me. Your throne will remain established forever." And that word has to trump any other word. Yes, they'll both come to pass, but Yahweh is not going to let King David's kingdom and his kingdom go down the tube. But things seem perhaps a bit tipsy, but here in chapter 17, things may be looking up, because we see here that God is preserving his kingdom, even though it looked like it may have been down for the count. Now, we see here a few weeks ago when we were in chapter 12, I mentioned to you that there was in chapter 12 another attribute of God that you don't always hear about. And we call that the deviousness of God. You have to look at that in context. And tonight there's another attribute of God that you don't always see discussed in theology books. And that's the doggedness of God. And you see it here in 2 Samuel 17. Now, the kingdom of God can look kind of tipsy, and in our own day as well. Especially for Christians and God's people who may be in other parts of our world just now, Christians in Nigeria or Eritrea or North Korea or over 24 other places across our globe where they are suffering for giving credence and homage to Jesus as their king. But there's still a sure word, like 2 Samuel 7, 16. There's still a sure word that overshadows it all. And though 2 Samuel 7, 16 is still the case, but there's also something like Daniel 2, 44. "The God of heaven will set up a kingdom, and it shall stand forever." And there's a tenacious endurance he has about seeing that that kingdom is preserved. Now, he does that here in 2 Samuel 17. How does God preserve his kingdom? Well, we notice several matters here. The first is there's a sovereignty that is quiet. Verses 1 to 14, a sovereignty that is quiet. Now, you see the chapter opening with Ahithophel's plan. Ahithophel is the counselor par excellence. We just saw that in the end of chapter 16. If you have Ahithophel as your counselor, it was like getting a word from God himself. He was so accurate, etc. and all that. So we've just come from that in chapter 16, and that's where the chapter divisions, which were put in later and so on, we need them, you know, for convenience sake, but they kind of get in the way sometimes. And if you come from right at the end of chapter 16 and come right into 17, and without thinking, oh, there's a thing that says chapter 17 there, there's a little break. No, just don't let there be a break. There's no counselor like Ahithophel, and then you meet in the first three verses Ahithophel's plan. This is the plan to use if you're following chapter 16 rightly. Now, notice what he says as you look there in those first three verses. Ahithophel says he'll select a sizable body of troops and he'll pursue David immediately tonight. So it'll be quick. He'll strike while David's people are tired and exhausted, throw them into a panic, and drive them off in a rout. So it will be devastating. And then he says that he will execute only David, so it will be limited in scope. And then he says that with David eliminated, Absalom will receive the loyalty of the people that follow David, will receive that back, because if David is gone, there's no reason to continue the conflict, and so it will be effective. So he is saying to Absalom and company, my plan will be quick, devastating, limited, and effective. And verse 4, it seemed right to Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Favorable response. Yep, Ahithophel has hit it on the snaz again. I don't know what made him do it. I can't really explain verses 5 and 6. Why then did Absalom say, tell you what, why don't we call Hushai the Archite and listen to what he has to say as well? Hushai, of course, is pro-David. He's pretending to be supporting Absalom and somebody, why he did that. And then not only that, but in verse 6, they tell Hushai exactly what it was that Ahithophel had counseled, what his plan was. So Hushai, and when he gives his advice, is not in the dark about what he's up against. He knows exactly what Ahithophel has said and how he needs to argue. Oh, and so that leads in, doesn't it, to Hushai's appeals. You notice them in verses 7 to 13. You'll notice that Hushai's speech and advice is about 2 to 3 times as long as Ahithophel's. He pads it. He talks about bears being robbed of their cubs and sand on the seashore and men with the heart of a lion, and he has some rhetorical flourishes, and he pads it and so on, makes it sound really good and so on. That's an interesting study, but we don't need to go into that. I just want you to notice, when Absalom so much as says, okay, this is what Ahithophel said, can you top that? And Hushai makes certain appeals. I think that's the best way to get at his advice as you look at it there. Notice that, first of all, he appeals to logic and knowledge in verse 8 through the first of verse 9. He says, you know, the you's emphatic there. You, Absalom, know your father and his men, what warriors they are, and terribly bitter, etc., and so on. If Ahithophel has forgotten the kind of fighter and warrior David is, you, Absalom, at least know. You don't have to be told. So he's appealing to his knowledge and his logic. And in the first part of verse 9, he says, and even now, David is no dodo. He's hidden himself in some pit somewhere. He's not with the troops. He knows what he's doing. It's all very well for Ahithophel to say, I will only strike down David. He can't even find David if he goes there. David won't be with the rest of the troops. But you know what kind of a warrior your father is. So he appeals to his knowledge and logic. And then he appeals to caution and fear in the last of verse 9, verse 10. Now he says, there always comes a point when an attack and so on, when there are some casualties. And the problem is, you if you go and you strike soon and so on, there'll be some casualties. There'll be a report and some of the men with Absalom have fallen and so on. And that'll spread some panic through the commando group and so on that Ahithophel would lead and so on. That could be disastrous. What he's basically saying to Absalom is, you know, Absalom, this is an audacious plan that Ahithophel is giving you, but there's a thin line between audacity and stupidity. And so he appeals to caution and fear. And then he appeals to vanity in verse 11. So he says, I'll tell you what I would say. What you need to do is take the time to collect an army from Dan to Beersheba, from Maine to Florida, get a total, an all Israel army, and you exercise your charisma and leadership, and you personally go among them. Not some underling taking a group of commandos, etc., but this requires your leadership, Absalom. Yeah. So he's appealing to his vanity in verse 11. And then he appeals to hatred and vengeance in verses 12 and 13. Is as if to counter Ahithophel's point about only striking down David and the rest of Israel and David's supporters will come back to Absalom. He says, you know, Absalom, you don't really want to do that, you know. You don't want anybody that's half-hearted. You don't want any pro-David folks still hanging around. We need to wipe the whole contingent out. He appeals to his hatred and vengeance. Yeah, we'll take them all out. So those are Hushai's appeals. We don't want half measures. You want your kingdom to be secure, don't you, Absalom? And that sort of thing. So we'll wipe out all the opposition. And so you have a second decision, and you see it in the first of verse 14. Then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. So, now, this of course, advice of Hushai will be helpful to David because it will buy him time. It'll take time, you know, to amass an army and all of that. And so this is buying David time. But you might wonder, how is it that they would think this way? How is it that Hushai's advice won out? Well, I don't know all of it, but I think I know the key to it. Ahithophel knew how to take David out, and it would have probably worked. But Hushai knew how to stroke egos. You need to go and lead these people yourself, Absalom. He knew, you know what your father's like, even though Ahithophel may not be up on David's prowess and so on. So he knew how to stroke egos, and it won out. So you go from Ahithophel's plan to Hushai's appeals, and then the last of verse 14 to Yahweh's secret, to his hidden decree. Why is it that Absalom and his cronies decided that the advice of Hushai was better than Ahithophel's? The last of verse 14. Now, Yahweh, emphatic subject, Yahweh had ordained to frustrate the good counsel of Ahithophel in order that Yahweh might bring disaster upon Absalom. There's a secret behind it all. Why that decision? Well, this is the explanation. Now, you have to say, you notice there that it says, Yahweh ordained to frustrate the good counsel of Ahithophel. You have to understand the way it's using the term good counsel. It doesn't mean good counsel in the sense of good morally. It's using it in the sense of good, in the sense of it would have been effective. It would have been pragmatically good. It would have worked. Not that it was a morally good counsel. But you see, why is it there that they make that decision? Well, Yahweh had ordained to frustrate the good counsel of Ahithophel, because Yahweh wanted to bring disaster upon Absalom. That's a little bit of a scary verse in a way. That's an explanation, and yet Absalom and his cronies made that decision so naturally, so freely, so humanly, so properly. And of course, any time you have something coming in here that suggests the sovereignty of God, like the last of verse 14, people get concerned about whether Absalom was really free or not. Yes, sure he was. Don't worry about Absalom's precious little free will. The sovereignty of God is not meant to cause you philosophical problems. It's meant to give you spiritual comfort. And God is in control here, and He is ordering events. And Absalom and his cronies freely make the choice they made. If you doubt that, dig Absalom up and resuscitate him and stick a microphone in front of his mouth and say, "Absalom, was that really what you wanted to do there? Didn't you feel coerced? No, we really wanted to do that. We thought that was the best plan." So he made that freely, but Yahweh is ordaining things. He ordained to frustrate the counsel of Ahithophel in order that Yahweh might bring disaster upon Absalom. That's a sovereignty that is quiet. It's just there in the last of verse 14. It's as if it's a theological aside. You're not ringing any bells there. Sometimes, like Yahweh's quiet sovereignty, the quietness is sometimes the most effective, isn't it? About 1995, there was a funeral in Dallas, Texas. I think it was at a Methodist church. It was the funeral of the Yankee star outfielder Mickey Mantle. Number 7 in the Yankees uniform, especially in the 1960s and so on. So it was Mantle's funeral and so on. There were certain people there, and one of them was Stan Musial, the star first baseman outfielder for the St. Louis Cardinals. He was there. He didn't have any part in the service or anything. Bobby Richardson of Sumter was one of Mantle's teammates, and he gave the message at the funeral. But Stan Musial was there in the audience, in the congregation. He was just there. He had been recently, I think, diagnosed with prostate cancer, but he was there. He was the greatest National League hitter probably for 2 decades. And he was just there as a quiet tribute. It was a class act, you might say, that he was there for Mickey Mantle's memorial service. But it was all just very quiet. But sometimes that's the most effective. And that's what you see here. It's a sovereignty that's quiet. It's a hidden decree, you might say. And frequently God's work is like that. It's unseen. It's hidden behind the conversations and the decisions and the activities and the crises of our lives. He doesn't usually publicize His sovereignty. He just exercises it. And just because He's not obvious does not mean He is absent. It's a sovereignty that is quiet. And you see something else here as Yahweh preserves His kingdom, and that is a providence that is exciting. Verses 15 to 22, a providence that is exciting. So in the last of verse 14, Yahweh's sovereignty, that is His control over men and events and His ruling of these and structuring of them, His sovereignty is exercised quietly. But His providence, the outworking of His sovereignty in events and so on, His His providence can give cardiologists business. And you see that in verses 15 to 22. Just because Yahweh ordains this matter and so on in defeating Absalom and so on, still in bringing it about and all of that, it gets quite exciting, a little bit nail-biting and so on. You notice the you have to assume the nature of the conference that took place between Absalom and his advisor or his conferees, his cronies, and so on. You notice in verses 15 and 16 that Hushai goes to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, who were also pro-David, and he tells them, Ahithophel advised Absalom this way, and this is how I advised him, so now you need to hurry and get word to David in case they follow Ahithophel's advice that he not spend the time west of the Jordan. He needs to get across the river, etc., be more protected. That's a yes. Now, why did Hushai say that? Well, because he didn't know. It says in the first of verse 14, Absalom and company said, oh, Hushai's counsel is better than Ahithophel's. But Hushai didn't know that. When they got the word from Hushai and they got his advice and so on, then they sent him out of the room and then they made their decision after that. So Hushai wasn't clued in. He wasn't there when they made the decision to follow Hushai's advice. So he didn't know how it would go. And so he had to go on a worser case scenario that they might follow Ahithophel's advice and go after David immediately and so on. So he had to counsel the priests to do that. And of course, their sons, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, were at the spring of Rogel, a little outside of Jerusalem, etc. And they were waiting there. The plan was that, a girl may be going there under the guise of getting water and so on. And she would slip word to them and then they would take off and go take word to David. So, the fifth column runs into difficulty in the first part of verse 18 because a lad saw them. Absalom probably had his spies everywhere. He told Absalom. And so Jonathan and Ahimaaz had to make tracks as quickly as they could. They had to improvise. And they came to a village near Jerusalem, Bakarim. And there was a fellow there that they apparently knew was loyal to David. And they went into the courtyard of his house and went down into a well. And his wife covered it over with a canvas or something. And then she spread, I was going to say collards there, but they weren't. It was grain, I'm sure, of some kind. But she spread it out over the canvas and so on. It's as if nothing had happened. And they come, Absalom's fellows come looking for him and so on. But you see how exciting this is? A little bit. It's just not all calm. When the Lord works, sometimes your blood pressure can go up. And that's what happens here. It's a providence that is exciting in that sense. So it keeps you on pins and needles. Now, God's providence isn't always that way, but often in redemptive history it is, isn't it? You run into these things. Where are you in Exodus 2, 5 and 6? Well, this Egyptian teenager has just pulled a Hebrew infant out of the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And in those moments, whether she drops him back into the Nile, as the law of the land says she should, or whether she holds him fast, determines the destiny of all of Israel because Moses will be their deliverer and so on. And it's a pretty tense moment. It can keep you on the edge of your seat if you get into it, you know. Or you go to 2 Kings chapter 11 in history later than David, But we're in the kingdom of Judah, and there is this queen mother, Athaliah, who is a godless old sow. And she really is. And she decides to exterminate all the seed, the royal seed. That's the seed of David's line of kings. Her son has been killed in battle. Now she's going to wipe out all the royal descendants, the kids. Nice way to treat your grandchildren and so on. Grab power for herself and so on. Well, if that's successful in 2 Kings 11, what's going to happen? The Davidic covenant of 2 Samuel 7 is going to fall flat on the ground. It just so happens that there's a wife of a priest. Her name is Jehosheba. And she grabs an infant Joash and she spirits him away and she crams him and into a wardrobe or something in the temple complex and keeps him and gets him in her own apartment and so on and raises him until time for a coup. But how on edge things were there. Or you go toward the end of the Old Testament period and the book of Esther, don't you? Esther 5 and 6. And Esther has finally gotten the nerve and so on and has asked the king to come to a banquet, and she'll make her request. She wants to make her request for her people, Israel, to be saved from the execution that Haman has placed on the royal calendar and so on. It's between banquets. There was the first one, and she told the king that she would tell him her request at the second banquet. And it begins to look a little bit up for Israel, perhaps, at this point, though it's not still not determined. But yet there's a subplot that enters, and not everybody who's working with the book of Esther notices the subplot. Esther will, at the second banquet, make her request for Israel to be preserved from Haman's decree. But there's something else that enters in that as Haman goes over his resume, perhaps boring his loyal household to death, he says, but all of this does me no good as long as that Jew Mordecai is there at the king's gate and he doesn't do me homage and he doesn't respect me. And his wife and his cronies say to him, "Oh, why don't you speak to the king first thing in the morning before Starbucks opens up? And go in and ask him to have Mordecai hung, and so on. And then you can go to the banquet with a light and frivolous heart as you go with the king to Esther's banquet." So he decides to do that. And then you have that little hinge in the book of Esther, don't you? On that night, the king could not sleep. Psalmanex didn't work. He had to listen to his equivalent of the congressional record being read and so on. He found written, it just so happened, right, that the part they were reading told about Mordecai foiling an assassination attempt on Ahasuerus. And he said, "Has anything been done for this fellow?" And they said, "No." And he said, so he's thinking, "What can I do to reward this fellow for Mordecai, for this wonderful preserving of my life and so on?" And it's just then that Haman comes in. Haman comes in thinking about hanging Mordecai. Ahasuerus is geared to honor Mordecai. And you see, whatever happened to Israel, Mordecai could have been toast. But it just so happened that on that night, the king could not sleep. Yahweh has a way sometimes of keeping you on edge. Sometimes his providence can be quite exciting, as it is here. A little harum scarum in the text, right? And so on. Now, so a providence that is exciting. Is there any usefulness behind that point? I think there is. I think there's, let me just put it this way. I think what we learn from this is this. It is the nature of God to be interesting. You may be often perplexed. You may be baffled, and you may be confused in your circumstances. But you're never bored with God, are you? He has a way of pricking your interest, you know. Sometimes it can be a little too hair-raising, perhaps. But God is always interesting. I've told you a couple times before, I'm sure, you know, that little account about Theodore Roosevelt when he was president. So we're back about 1900, but early years of the 20th century. And here's Teddy Roosevelt, and the French ambassador visits him at the White House. And so they play a couple sets of tennis, and then they go jogging on the White House lawn. And then after that, they have a workout with the medicine ball. And then in typical, I say typical, I never knew Teddy, from what I've read of him, in typical Teddy Roosevelt fashion, he says to him, "What would you like to do now?" And the French ambassador says, "It is all the same to you, Mr. President. I'd just like to lie down and die." Well, he was exhausted, but he wasn't bored. And the providence of the God of heaven never bores us. God is able to keep you interested. So what do you have here? Well, you have a sovereignty that is quiet. You have a providence that is exciting. And you have a suicide, thirdly, a suicide that is prophetic. Now, this is unique to 2 Samuel 17. God doesn't always preserve his kingdom this way, but Ahithophel makes a decision. Look at verse 23. Now Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been carried out, so he saddled his donkey, got up, and went to his house, to his city. He organized his affairs and hung himself. So he died and was buried in his father's grave. Now you might say, now Ahithophel, why did he do that? Was he just ticked off because his advice hadn't been followed, and so he was going to spite Absalom by removing himself or something? Was that stupid? No. Ahithophel probably wouldn't overreact. Ahithophel wouldn't do anything stupid, not Ahithophel. Everything with Ahithophel was calculated and thought out. And what was his reasoning behind this? Well, it could be a couple of things. One, which I'm not convinced of, but one could be that he saw that since Absalom and cronies, etc., did not follow his advice in going after David, he saw that Absalom had a will of his own. And he saw that Absalom would not necessarily always follow his advice. And so there was no hope of Ahithophel being the real power behind the throne, with Absalom kind of reigning as a figurehead. Absalom had a bit of a mind of his own. And when he saw that, maybe it so discouraged him that he decided put an end to himself. I don't think that's the most likely scenario. I think that he knew when Absalom and company followed Hushai's advice that Absalom's cause was doomed. David would have time to retrench. Absalom, and even outnumbering David's forces, Absalom would not have the skill against David. He was smart enough to know that Absalom had doomed his chances, and he knew that David would be back in power. And because of that, he himself would be likely to be executed as a traitor. And he preferred a private suicide now to a public execution later. In other words, Ahithophel could see the handwriting on the wall. And so he did away with himself. Now, what's the significance of this? I don't think we want to gloat over Ahithophel's deed at all, and the scripture doesn't gloat over it, but we need to ask the significance of it. Ahithophel's suicide here, or his death just in itself, is not just a bare event, but I suggest that it has prophetic, quote unquote, import. There's something prophetic about that. That is, Ahithophel stands for a sort of a microcosm of all the opponents and enemies of not only David, but of God's kingdom. He's sort of a representative figure of all God's enemies who, like Ahithophel, seek to assault his kingdom and his anointed king in one way or another. And this is an indication of the kind of thing that will happen. They will be taken out of the way. So this is a kind of a preview. It's a kind of a precursor of a much greater matter of the way God's enemies and the enemies of Christ and his kingdom will not succeed. Let me try to put it. I don't know if I mentioned it to you before, but there was a, let me try to boil it down into a scenario. There was, in the last days of the Second World War, in early 1945, I think it was, the last days of the Third Reich, Allied bombers came over near Berlin and so on, bombing. And the Rudolf Reschke was a 14-year-old lad. His mother grabbed Rudolf and brought him down into the cellar where he joined his mother and his 9-year-old sister. They were shivering and crying. The shelter was shaking. The plaster fell. The lights blinked, and then they went out. The mother and the sister began to pray, and soon Rudolf joined them in that. But the bombing grew worse, and the shelter just shuddered. And they'd been through many air raids and bombing raids, but none apparently this severe. And Rudolf's mother, with her arms about both her children, sat there and began sobbing. Rudolf knew she was worried because his father was fighting at the front in the German army. And then here they were in this shelter and so on. And finally, he was angry at the planes because of the devastating effect they were having on his mother. And apparently he was angry at something else even more than that. And before his mother could do anything, Rudolf jumped up and ran out of the shelter. He ran into their ground floor apartment. He went into his room and he took to his toy soldiers, and he took a soldier with these dolls and so on with certain features painted on his face. He grabbed that. He went into the kitchen. He hefted down his mother's big meat cleaver, and he ran out into the courtyard of the apartment building, and he placed that doll, that soldier, on the ground. Then he took the meat cleaver and with one stroke he whacked off its head. A head that had the features of Adolf Hitler painted on it. "There," he cried as the tears coursed down his face. He stood unrepentantly over the loose head of Adolf Hitler. But that was only a piece of violence against a toy soldier. That was sort of, you might say, a vignette of what would happen on April 30th, 1945, when Hitler himself took a Walther pistol, put it into his mouth, and blew his brains out. It was a sort of a precursor of that later deed. That's the kind of thing you have here with Ahithophel. Ahithophel, as I say, is a kind of a microcosm and represents all of God's and Christ's enemies who would inhibit and oppose and destroy his kingdom and so on. But this is a view that is saying, no, Yahweh takes care of those enemies of his kingdom. Don't fear that. I think it's an encouragement to God's people, as if to say, this is the end of all those who oppose God and his kingdom. The Absaloms and the Adolfs, the Stalins and the Sennacheribs, all rot and perish in the various junkyards of history. But there's solace for God's saints. Because, not because all your crises, all your personal crises are going to go away. No, they won't. And not because you'll necessarily have serenity and peace and everything. And not because your own nation will never bite the dust in ruin. But because the God of heaven has set up a kingdom. And it shall stand forever. And none of the Ahithophels of this age will be able to overthrow it. Let's pray. Our Father and our God, we do thank you that you seem to want us, your people, to have a firm anchorage. Not always, O Lord, that all our possible difficulties are solved and we have personal peace in everything. But we have a deep and abiding peace because we know that Christ will reign where'er the sun does its successive journeys run, and Christ will have dominion over land and sea. Earth's remotest regions shall his empire be, and no one will be able to stop you faithfully fulfilling your promise. So grant that we would be anchored in that. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.